Martin Luther King Day is the time for storytelling, telling stories of liberation and locating ourselves in those stories. I love this holiday. The Song at the Sea must have been an incredible party. Can you imagine being there when the Israelites have walked through the Red Sea, this giant cavern of water? They arrive at the other side with the Egyptian army wiped out behind them, and they arrive safely on their way to the Promised Land. I'll bet it must have been better than any New Year's party I have ever attended. If you're like me, you have a pretty clear picture of what the whole thing looked like. As Charlton Heston raises his mighty staff, and the waters part. There's another story of how that all worked, though, that I want to share with you. This other story comes to us through the Jewish storytelling tradition of Midrash. The story says that when Moses and his people were trapped between the army and the sea, the people began yelling at Moses, asking why he had taken them out of the safety of slavery in Egypt. Frustrated, Moses does what any of us would have done in this moment. He turns to God and says, "Well, what now?" If you have ever felt like you were trapped between an army and a sea, would you say out loud right now, "What now?" Well, God rebukes Moses and tells him to turn around and just keep walking and stop complaining. He doesn't, though. He freezes. So a man named Nachshon, a leader of his tribe, begins to wade into the water. Nachshon believes in God. He has faith in the path ahead of him, and he steps into the waters expecting them to part, but they don't. So he walks in all the way up to his waist, getting soaked, expecting the waters will part, but they don't. When he is up to his neck, he is sure God will part the waters then, but it doesn't happen. It's only, we are told, when the water begins to lap up over his nostrils and he begins gasping for breath that God parts the way. God wanted to free the Israelites, but they had to do their part first. Liberation didn't come because they sat back in comfort and asked politely. If you have ever worked to change a large institution or a government, the story of Nachshon may feel familiar to you. He was in almost over his head before the way cleared. If that's been your experience, would you say out loud right now, "Over my head"? Wade in the water, God's gonna trouble the water. Why would Nachshon do such a thing? What gives a person that kind of faith in the path before them? When I hear a story like this, I try to ask myself, honestly, who would I be if I was in this story? What character would I play? When I am honest with myself, I recognize that I am probably not Nachshon. I'm probably not Moses or the Pharaoh either. I'd like to think that of the bystanders watching Nachshon wade into the water, I would at least have been one of the supportive ones. Keep up the good work, Nachshon. I'm right behind you as soon as it's dry. I picture myself standing on the shore watching him wade in and cough as the water laps up over his nostrils. And he's clearing his throat, gasping for air. I can picture myself just calling out to him, "Let me know if you need me to sign a petition." We are in troubled water today, though. African Americans and communities of color this year have been lifting up the issues of racial justice in our society and showing us how much work there is left to do. People are taking to the streets in Missouri and Ohio and New York after the killings of so many young black men and after the lack of trials for their shooters. The truth is that people like Nachshon are today wading into troubled water all around us. And as a denomination, as a faith community, it is time for us to decide whether we're going to stand on the shore and cheer them from afar, or whether we're going to get our feet wet. Troubled only begins to describe the world around us. Shane Claiborne, a radical Christian activist, speaks of trying to find the strength to work for love and justice, to work for wholeness even amidst the brokenness of this world. He describes that courage, that motivation to move forward into the waters, saying, "Some of us have just caught a glimpse of the promised land. And it is so dazzling," he says, "our eyes are forever fixed on it, never to look back at the ways of that old empire again." If you have ever had a vision of a better world, would you say out loud right now, "Glimpse of the promised land"? Dr. King, in the tradition of community leaders like Nakshon, also surely had a glimpse of the promised land, a vision of the beloved community, as he famously called it, a vision that pulled him deep into troubled waters, over his head, certainly. I love King Day. I love this holiday and this celebration of history and looking together at the work still before us, but it also makes me a little nervous when I'm honest. I get worried that it's easier to talk about the civil rights movements of the past, which are over and done with and settled, than it is to discuss the current movements for civil rights that are reaching out to us, begging for solidarity. I get worried that if we think of King as a saint, which certainly he was, I might feel as though I'm off the hook for doing similar work, since I am a mere mortal. And I get worried that as a white person in the U.S., I was always taught to never speak of race. I was taught the way to be non-racist was to never mention the subject. I worry we might quarantine our discussion of race to this one weekend every year, which almost by definition means separating these issues from the conversations of our daily lives. One of the first real discussions I ever participated in on race and racism that kind of broke through these lessons I had learned about not speaking of it was at a Unitarian Universalist annual meeting. I was at a white identity group, a dozen white college and high school students sitting in a circle talking about race in our country, and somebody said these words that just hit me. They said, "Racism is the name of a system that pushes down one group of people, people of color, but the other half of the system is lifting up another group with unearned advantage, white people." I've gone on to learn more since then of what that pushing down and lifting up looks like in our world, but that first sentence was so meaningful for me because for the first time it included me in the story, my place in this story of race in our country. I started to look back on my life and see all these forces that, kind of like gravity, had been pushing me in a certain direction, silently but surely. There was the time the police let me go with a warning, the first good-paying job I got through a family friend, everyone who ever said I looked like a leader. There was the other time the police let me go with a warning. There were the honors classes I took, which were largely segregated, strangers who naturally trusted me, my own trust in the government to be on my side, and last but not least, there was the other time the police let me go with a warning. I encourage you to search "criming while white" to see and maybe even add to the list of stories of white folks getting away with crimes, sometimes with the help of the police. I could add to the list myself. Coming to look honestly at this place, at my place, in this old empire of ours has felt like being in over my head. How uncomfortable to realize that, my best intentions aside, I am sometimes in the place of the Israelites fleeing the Egyptians, and I am sometimes also the Egyptians. Most of the Egyptians weren't bad people. They were just part of an unjust system. No individual was the problem of Egyptian society, but they were part of these institutions where the exploitation of the most vulnerable was just built into the structures of their economy. Martin Luther King speaks of the different roles that we must play in talking about the mass movement of people of color working for change. He went on to say, "Whites, it must frankly be said, are not putting in a similar mass effort to re-educate themselves out of their racial ignorance." This is one of his less popular quotes. It is an aspect of their sense of superiority that white people of America believe they have so little to learn. I don't know if there is a God out there who has specific opinions about how we go about bringing change to the world, but my experience tells me that God or no God, some plans work better than others, and sitting back in comfort and asking nicely for change tends not to work. It's rare to find a story of societal transformation without some troubled water. These words spoken by Martin Luther King about re-educating ourselves may as well have been said by Moses about the Egyptians. He spoke of this unique role of people with honor and privilege, saying, "Integration is meaningless without the sharing of power." He says, "When I speak of integration, I don't mean a romantic mixing of colors. I mean a real sharing of power and responsibility." The Egyptians weren't bad people, but they were in power, and something about privilege feels a lot like wearing blinders. They received some unearned benefits by living in this tiered society. And we can't speak of the Egyptians or of King's work without speaking about the role of power in liberation. Some have mistaken the spiritual, nonviolent civil disobedience of King as a way of taking power off of the table, removing it from the equation entirely. But nothing could be further from the truth or King's philosophy. The nonviolent tradition that King inherited from Gandhi, Satyagraha, the soul force, is a way of not just asking that power be shared politely, but requiring that it be shared and grounding it in values of equity and compassion. King said, "Power properly understood is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose. It is the strength required to bring about social and political and economic advantage. What is needed is that a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, but love without power is sentimental and anemic." The sneaky thing about the unearned powers and privileges and benefits I've received as a white person is that I didn't ask for them. It's been like finding some extra money in my pants pocket after doing the laundry. I love when that happens. All along the way, my employers and the police and locally funded schools and standardized tests and family connections and the housing market have all been quietly slipping money and other benefits into my back pocket. I never needed to pay attention, and in fact, I was encouraged not to. But walking intentionally into uncomfortable conversations about race, going into the discomfort, sometimes up to my neck, has given me, if not a glimpse of the promised land, at least a vision of the way forward. Once the Israelites were out of the desert and the way forward looked difficult, some of them, we are told, asked Moses to take them back to the comfort of Egypt. I can understand that. What's a person like me to do when I inherit money accumulated by my parents or grandparents at a time when their careers and even their neighborhoods were closed off to communities of color? Looking around at the systems of inequity in this old empire is uncomfortable. Finding all those dollar bills and benefits in my back pocket feels a little bit like being trapped in Egypt as an Egyptian. But wading through those waters can bring us to the other side, can bring us towards the promised land, where we can realize that promised land of justice and equity and compassion that we have envisioned in our hearts and articulated in our principles. I can't say for sure which character in the Exodus story I would have been. I can say I have known some modern-day Nakshones. Do you know people like that in your life? If so, would you say out loud right now, "Modern-day Nakshone"? I am planning to try my best to follow them into the water. Coming of age in Unitarian Universalist community challenged me to think about how change happens, how we move from the world as it is to the world as we might create it together, the world as it might be. We have a strong, beautiful tradition of heresy that I hope isn't coming to an end anytime soon. Today, through the Standing on the Side of Love campaign, Unitarian Universalists all over the country are exploring what it means to live our faith and our values in this broken world, to lift up our voice into the public sphere. We are reaching out to the marginalized among us and forming partnerships with those in our community, moving towards the troubled waters and working for justice. You use all over the country are working with reproductive justice organizations to expand the idea of pro-choice, to look at the wholeness of families and how race and class affect our ability to take care of our bodies, how environmental justice pollutes some neighborhoods while others are more clean. Unitarian Universalists are exploring the justice system and the prison system to partner with the marginalized among us, to partner with organizations working for reform. We are working with immigrant groups to recognize the wholeness of families so that they aren't broken apart. We are stepping into that water together. We are expanding our circle of love and justice every time we gather to worship and recommit ourselves to that work, and every time we go out into the streets and into the committee rooms to find out how we can do the work better together. The next time a friend or family member asks you what exactly it is you do here in this strange community of heretics, don't tell them a list of things we don't believe in. Instead, if there is a story from your life when someone in this community waded into some troubled water and then looked back at you and took your hand and invited you to join them in living your truth more fully, share that story. We are a people of love and justice. We are better together. Seeking out activists working for racial justice and listening to their stories is one way we can do this work integrated with our whole lives. There are so many ways that we can integrate the spirit of King Day into every day of the year, where we can live our values more fully 6 days a week. Seeking out mentors who are racial justice mentors is one way to do it. Would you say racial justice mentors? Do you have people like that in your life? I encourage you to sit down with them, buy them a cup of coffee, and ask them how they do it. Seek out activists working for racial justice, read their books, read their blogs, and share their Facebook updates. I invite you to stop investing in businesses owned by wealthy white men and move your money to communities of color and democratically run businesses. Would you say, move your money? I invite you to show up for the issues and meetings and marches and conversations that matter most to immigrants and the other marginalized people among us. Would you say, show up? I invite you to imagine together what your committee meetings and family dinners and daily to-do lists and reading lists and careers would look like approached from a context of racial justice. Would you say, imagine together? I invite you to join me in the heresy of returning any unearned money you may find in your back pocket. I invite you to think of a modern-day Nakshon and ask them how they do it. I invite you to wade into the troubled water of conversation and of action. I invite you to turn your back on this old empire of ours and catch a glimpse of the promised land. I invite you to join me in recommitting to a Unitarian Universalism that speaks of a promised land in the here and the now, and walks into the water to get there together. Would you say together? I invite you to join me in standing on the side of love. Would you say love?